No mai, te opoko o te ika. It is the Etu Whānau Footy Show. It is a celebration weekend, the 25th of July, 100 years since the first radio rugby commentary in Te Whanganui at Tata Wellington. And why not speak to one of the legends of radio rugby commentary, or television radio rugby commentary, Keith Quinn. Kia ora, Keith.
Kia ora, Dave. You're not suggesting I was there 100 years ago when it started, I hope, but very nice to talk to you, and very nice to talk about the much praised and honourable history that the radio has in broadcasting the great game of rugby union in our region and in our country.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the history of radio commentary shortly. But just firstly yourself, Keith, you went to Wellington College and you left Wellington College and you went directly into broadcasting. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, and funnily enough, there was a slight connection in when I was in Wellington College. The great Winston McCarthy was a radio commentator then. He came to the old cricket pavilion at Wellington College one day on a rainy day to broadcast Wellington College playing St. Pat's. And you had to stay out of the rain. So I thought, what better place to go up onto the top deck of the cricket pavilion? And lo and behold, there was Winston McCarthy, whose voice was famous. And I crept around as a schoolboy and stood behind him. And with him commentating that day was the South African, great South African administrator and former Springbok, Danny Craven. And they did the commentary of the game. And I remember being so excited that I was in the company of these two very famous men. And it might have even got my blood boiling in excitement about radio, about broadcasting and so on. So that was my first contact. Yeah, but I went to Wellington College, a very modest career at Wellington College. And my mother, she knew somebody in broadcasting, and she got an appointment for me down at the new broadcasting house in Bowen Street. And I went down and was interviewed by a guy called David Williams, Doc Williams we called him, whose father had been a commentator before World War II, Charlie Williams, one of the very first radio broadcasters. And I know that I kind of sailed through that interview because I was by then really interested in broadcasting and sports results and which club was playing which club and which rep team was playing rep team and who were the All Blacks and who should be in and who shouldn't be in and so on. And it all came from those modest beginnings, I guess, at Wellington College, which meant that by the time my schooling was up, all I wanted to be was to be a sports reporter of some kind, a newspaper man or radio man. TV didn't exist, but my mother knew the lady in radio who got me the interview, and from there on, in my world, the rest is history.
Wow, so Winston McCarthy and Danny Craven maybe sparked the interest. So tell us, Keith, when you actually first got behind a mic and switched on the button.
Well, of course, I had to do... when I first joined broadcasting, and I was still playing rugby myself in Wellington, people used to say to me, what are you doing for now that you've left school? And I'd say, I've joined broadcasting. And let's say... They just assumed that if you joined broadcasting, you'd be on the air commentating rugby the following Saturday. Well, it didn't work like that because I joined in 19, when I came out of Wellington College. This is a long time ago now, Dave, in 1965, and I never broadcast a commentary for about 6 or 7 years. I appeared on TV before, long before I did any commentaries. But my first time I switched on a commentary, now that I think about it, was in Auckland when I transferred to Auckland and I was given the chance to do a test match on commercial radio, which was just starting up. So I went to the Cricket Box Pavilion at Eden Park and I broadcast the Lions against the All Blacks, the fourth test, in 1971. I didn't have a very good view of the game. I kind of looked at it corner on from one end, but I did my best to shine, And maybe somebody listened and heard me and thought, well, maybe we'll give him another go at this next season, and so on. So that was my first time that I can remember where it was kind of they'd never attempted anything like that in radio before. They interrupted the broadcast to broadcast horse racing. And so every now and then during the rugby test, I would be told in my earphones, pause here, Keith, we got the second leg coming in from Trentham. And I'd stop for a couple of minutes in the radio commentary, and then the voice in the headphones would say, OK, back to the rugby, and I'd carry on summarising what had gone before and back to the commentary on the game until someone said, hey, we got the first leg coming up from Hamilton or something to Rapa. And so on and so on, and that's how radio, commercial radio, took to broadcasting of rugby matches then, and I was right at the start of that.
Wow, as a proud Wellingtonian, I think we should ignore that your first ever radio broadcast was in Auckland.
Oh well, no, there was Noble broadcasting done in Wellington many years before that, and that's where Winston McCarthy came in. In the war years of World War II, there was broadcasts of rep rugby and army rugby interspersed, and the North-South game carried on. All test match rugby was stopped because of the war, but Winston McCarthy's voice became synonymous, and people became very familiar with his style, and so he broadcast the very first consistent radio broadcast. So I think Wellington was doing about the same level of consistent broadcasting as Auckland and Christchurch and Dunedin were. People in those towns who broadcast the rugby games during the latter years of the war became very famous in their towns. In the list of people, there was Bob Irvine and Colin Snedden, the cricketer in Auckland, and in Dunedin there was Ian Galloway. These guys became very famous, and Winston was perhaps the most famous of them all. They used to say, in fact, that apart from the Prime Minister of New Zealand, the most famous New Zealander was the guy that broadcast the big rugby matches, and that was then, in the later years of 1940s, was Winston McCarthy.
Wow. Just going back to your, you said you left school and you played a bit of rugby when you left school. Tell us about your lifelong allegiance to the Wellington Axemen Football Club.
You've been doing your research, Dave. That's impressive. I left school in 1964, so we're going back a long, long time now. In the school holidays, a mate of mine who went to Rongotai College, funnily enough, Peter Cowan, he said to me, what are you going to do in the school holidays? You're going to play rugby anywhere? I said, no, it's the holidays. There's no school rugby. And he said, well, come over with me to Haitaitai Park, because the college, the club rugby is continuing. So we got on our bikes, and we biked from where we lived up by Athletic Park, by McAllister Park, it is now. And we biked over to Haitaitai Park, and we arrived on the Tuesday night for practice. And on Saturday afternoon in 1963, my second to last year, I ran out against a club team wearing gold and black hoops of the Wellington Football Club. We weren't even nicknamed the Axemen then. We were just Wellington. And that was my club. They gave me a game. Since, and that's where I'll be tomorrow afternoon watching them play, because you have your loyalties, and my loyalty is to the Wellington Football Club, the mighty, mighty Axemen, even though we perhaps haven't finished high up in the tables in recent years, you still support your club colours, and I've always believed that. But no, that's my allegiance. I got as high as the honourable position of lock forward in the Senior B team one year when we won the Harper Lock Shield, and they still play for the Harper Lock Shield now, and so I always look for those results when they're posted, because it was a tough grade in those days, and I was very pleased and proud to play in that grade. But then I stopped to become a broadcaster because you couldn't do both on a Saturday afternoon. So I always joke to people that who knows where I would have gone if I hadn't have been become a broadcaster. But I know it deep in my heart that my failing eyesight and sluggish rugby wouldn't have taken me very far. But I always say to people, I'm still waiting by the phone for the selectors to ring me, even at my age now.
Just as an aside, how proud are you that they've had a fantastic 2026, haven't they, the Wellington X-Men, given recent seasons?
Oh, absolutely. One time, because I'm a bit of a record keeper, a historian, if you like, I jotted down all the results for a whole season, and we lost 7 games in a row in Premier Rugby. But this year we've turned that around. I think we've had about 5 wins, and we're still in the competition for the Hardham Cup. And some people rubbish the Hardham Cup for the second level of Premier Rugby and say it's the Hard Up Cup. But I say, look, it's named after a guy who won the Victoria Cross in battle. So it's a noble competition. And so I'm very proud that our team is now in the semi-finals of the Hardham Cup. And who knows, tomorrow we might win our way to the final. And who knows? We just don't know, do we, until the final whistles and the records are posted. But we're still in it, and it's a good, solid Premier Rugby competition.
Absolutely. So look, so tell us about how you moved from a radio cadetship at Broadcasting House into television. How did that all work?
It worked because I wanted to be a commentator. I was in Wellington, and Winston was still going. It was coming towards the end of his career, but there was another very good commentator in Wellington called Brian Russ. And so I thought, well, I can't get a start as a commentator. I'll see if I can transfer to Auckland. And so I did. And I got a job in the Auckland radio situation, 1ZB it was called. Wellington was 2ZB. Christchurch was 3ZB and Dunedin 4ZB. So I worked for 1ZB. And yes, I did get a start up there. I can remember broadcasting the Gallagher Shield final as a really young broadcaster, maybe only 23 years of age. And from Auckland, I got a bit of a reputation, and I went to the Olympic Games in Munich as a 24-year-old. It was incredibly a good thing for me to have done, to take a transfer to Auckland, and I wasn't there very long. By then I was married, my family was on the way, and we came back to Wellington, and we're Wellington people now, well and truly, again. But there was a time in Auckland, and a very important time in my life, where I got a start as a commentator, doing that Lions game I told you about, and then off to the Olympic Games, and so on. So a couple of years in Auckland got me going, and then I came back to Wellington.
What's the hardest, speaking of Olympic Games, what's the hardest sport you've ever commentated?
The hardest sport I've ever commentated? That is an extremely difficult question. I suppose the start of a marathon or something where there's hundreds of runners from all different shapes and sizes and colours and creeds, all going for their lives out of the stadium into the streets, and they're all running like hell, and you've got to keep up with it, and you're trying to do your best. But that hasn't changed. That's still the same today for any marathon race you see. And it's up to the broadcaster to have done their preparation and homework to know who each one is. I went to the Olympic Games, as a side to this interview, mate. I went to the Olympic Games 10 times and to the Commonwealth Games 10 times. So I kind of know those pitfalls. But if you ask me to name one most difficult one, it's a very difficult question. Perhaps I have to come back to the pronunciation of some of the people's names from some of the more exotic countries which are represented, thankfully, at the Olympic Games.
Yeah, because all your Olympic Games commentary work has been for television. Is that correct?
And well, no. The very first one I went to in Munich in 1972 was on radio. And if you can remember what happened, there was a terrorism attack in the Olympic Village. Well, I reported that back to the newsroom in Wellington, and that was broadcast on radio. And again, it was lucky for me because that was a lucky break, because previously the people in the newsroom, no disrespect, they thought that people in the sports office, they only talked about sport. Well, suddenly I was a sports reporter thrown into this terrorism reporting at the Munich Olympic Games, and I got a reputation for being a sports reporter who could talk for things a bit wider than sports. And it was very good for me. But again, I got to say, good luck involved. In fact, I wrote a book about my adventures around the world, and I called it A Lucky Man, because I know that played a big part in my time at the microphone.
Okay, and obviously you moved into the rugby sevens as well, so you've had quite an extensive career in all forms of all the codes and that. So how did you enjoy the sevens circuit?
Well, the sevens was wonderful as well. I told you about my Olympic and Commonwealth Games experience. Just hold your hat here, mate. I went to 122 cities in the world commentating the seven side tournaments. That was, again, I finished with the TV rights went from TVNZ, where I worked, over to Sky, and that's the way it works. Some stations outbid the others with their money, and they get the contracts and they take over broadcasting. And that situation exists in New Zealand. So at the end of my career in TVNZ, I was thinking, well, that's the end of it. I won't be broadcasting any more 15-a-side rugby. But suddenly they said, Keith, we've got this contract for the 7-a-side tour. How'd you like to do that? And I said, okay. And so off I went for about nearly 10 years. I finished my whole career as an international broadcaster in 2018. But I had started the sevens in about 1999. So of those 122 cities, they were dotted through about 10 or 11 cities every year for over a decade. And I went to some wonderful, wonderful places doing sevens. And then finally, the ultimate was to go to the Olympic Games in Nanjing in China, the Youth Olympic Games, where they reintroduced rugby into the Olympic program. And it was 7-a-side for women. The New Zealand Rugby Union didn't send a team to that tournament. So the gold medal was won by Australia. There was the men's was won by Argentina. And that was the Olympics coming back into the Olympic movement at Youth Olympic Games level. And then I went to Rio when it came back to full Olympic coverage. And the New Zealand women's team, they got a silver medal there to Australia. And the men's team got fifth. I think they were beaten on the first day by Japan. Sonny Bill Williams was in that team, but he broke his Achilles tendon on the first day in Rio, so that really set the New Zealand team back. But those two events were part of the pride that I have in the longevity of a broadcasting career, which started by standing behind Winston McCarthy up at Wellington College in the rain. So I've come a long way.
Danny Craven.
And Danny Craven, the great Danny Craven, who I broadcast a game with in Hong Kong. The IRB, the International Rugby Board, were trying to get a game going every couple of years between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere. to select two squads of teams from those two parts of the world, and they decided to hold it in Hong Kong. And so we went to Hong Kong, and we had it in the outer suburbs, and it was very difficult ground to find in the teeming housing and of the suburbs. And it was a football field, a soccer field, and they didn't have a broadcaster for me, so they said, here's Mr. Craven. Would you like to commentate with him? Well, I nearly fell over because this was wonderful. And he was so nice, and we got on so well. And we got a ride back to town in a Super Flash car with a flag flying in the front and through all the teeming traffic. And it was a great day. But they never carried on that Northern Hemisphere versus Southern Hemisphere teams. I guess it was too difficult to organise in all the rugby that's played these days around the world.
This will be a difficult question to answer, but what is your most memorable commentary?
Well, that's a toughie. I've got a few, Dave. When people ask me what's the most memorable game I ever did, they're having a reunion in Auckland when... Actually, it's this weekend. The team that beat South Africa in South Africa in 1996 to win the Test Series there, coached by John Hart. And he's got 18 of the team, of the squad there. Some of them have sadly passed away, people like Jonah Lomu and others. And he's got seven of the management team, and he's invited a couple of the prominent broadcasters to go. Unfortunately, I can't make it, but that was a fantastic game, of excitement all the way. We had to win the game to win the series, and the team did it. And if you remember, the video shows Sean Fitzpatrick and Zinzan Brook banging their fists into the ground at the end of the game, as it was so exciting at the end. Well, that was the greatest game I ever saw. But I also saw King Country challenge Hawke's Bay for the Ranfurly Shield in the late 60s. And having been born in Tikawiti, same as Colin Meads, Colin Meads ran out to captain King Country that day. And Hawke's Bay won by 19-16. But for a long time in the second half, I was trying to do the commentary, so excited that maybe little King Country could win the Ranfurly Shield. Alas, it didn't work out. And Kel Tremaine's Hawke's Bay team won by 3 points. And they shook hands at the end of the game, the two of them. I didn't know until they told me a couple of years later that Tremaine and Meads were such good mates. The Pointree Meads didn't stay in the hotel the night before the game. He stayed in with Kel Tremaine out at Kel Tremaine's place in Napier because they were such good mates. And the next day they went into this tremendous battle on McLean Park, a fantastic game. I think there were only 3 points for a try in those days. And I think there were four tries each in the final score of 19-16. A wonderful, wonderful game. Sunny day, there wasn't a cloud in the sky, and I've never felt so excited during the game and so disappointed afterwards that the little King Country couldn't get through. Those were the best two rugby games I ever did, but in terms of the Olympic Games, well, there were highlights every time, every day of the Olympic Games. And then, of course, I've got to remember Dick Taylor's 10,000 metres at Christchurch in 1974 at the Commonwealth Games, where I announced him during the race as Dick Taylor of Wellington, which was true because he was known as a Cantab, but he was associated with Marlborough in those days, and Marlborough was affiliated to the Wellington Athletics Association. And so I said he was from Wellington, and he's been calling himself, when I see him, because we've become really good friends, he says it's Dick Taylor of Wellington here when he calls me up on the phone. And he always reckons that his mother was disgusted in me in the commentary box because she always called him Richard Taylor. And she said when the race started, she switched on the TV to watch her Richard run in the race. And the commentator called him Dick. And Dick said, I started the race as Richard and ended it as Dick, and I've been a Dick ever since. So that's one of his all-time great stories. But that was one of the most exciting broadcasts I was ever involved with.
Look, just a couple more questions. But one I want to talk about is we're focusing on rugby radio commentary around Wellington, and what probably the finest radio commentator I've heard, with due respect to yourself, of course, is the late, great Graham Moody. Tell us about Graham Moody as a radio rugby commentator.
Well, if I start talking about Graham Moody, I might even start to cry, because he was such a lovely man. He was such a decent person. And I just never had a moment or a day when I didn't enjoy being in his company. And I remember one of the last joyous moments I had with Graham was when they invited John Macbeth and Graham Moody and I down to a studio in Wellington to record a song together. And we recorded the song, and it went to the top of the hit parade, although I doubt if it did, but I'm saying it did. We had such fun, and he was such a decent guy. And it was such a tragedy that he drowned when he was doing the sport that he was his other great sport of surfing, and over in Australia, where he went every summer to the same spot with his great friend Murray Mexted, who was one of the great All Blacks and out of our rugby club, and they were friends. I can't say enough about Moody. He was a very good commentator too. Because he knew the game. He'd played it at senior level and at Wellington College level as captain of the first 15, and he was one of the great broadcasters. And I never heard anyone ever say anything bad about Graham Moody. He was such a decent, honourable, lovely person.
Privileged to meet him a couple of times. Now, look, finally, Keith, how important is radio commentary and broadcasting in the community game today?
Well, it's a bit sad that it's lost a little bit of its significance now. I want to just expand on that. In the years when I first started listening to radio, and the great Winston McCarthy days, it was everything, because there was no TV to interrupt viewing, and so you had to get your information from radio. It was much more instant, and so people. That's why Winston McCarthy became so famous. And to get the results, if you played in the game on a Saturday afternoon, you would come back to the city afterwards to your clubhouse or your hotel. The pubs would take on looking after certain clubs. Our club was in Willis Street, the Carlton, and it's no longer there, sadly. I met my wife in the Carlton Hotel after a rugby game. So that's how important it was to our club. So you went in there and you waited until 6 o'clock, because the pub shut at 6 o'clock in the evening. And then you went out into the streets where the locals, boys, girls didn't do this job, it was boys, were standing with big armloads of the newspaper called the Sports Post, and you grabbed the Sports Post and gave the boy a sixpence or a threepence, the coins in those days, and you tore open the pages to read the results of the other games, because the other games were the other club rugby games in the community. And so if Wellington, my club, had played Paniki, that result was significant for us and Paniki. We wanted to know how Onslow had gone in their game against Petone, or how University had gone in their game against Oriental. And so we opened the pages and we looked down, And there would be not only just the scores, but a little report on each game in the community, written by one of the Evening Post's reporters, who they would send out to stand on the sideline in all rains, all weathers, to file a report back to the paper by telephone in the evenings, so that it would be published in time to be on the streets by 6 o'clock. So when all the guys came out of the pubs and were very pleased or disappointed in the day's results, they wanted to see what the other clubs around the city had done, because they were there in the Sports Post. And so the Sports Post was a famous part of Wellington for decades. And on the front page was always a cartoon drawn by the local cartoonist for the Evening Post, a man called Neville Lodge. And Neville Lodge would write a cartoon about sports that week, and it would be published right down the width of the paper, a paper that's about the same size as the Post is these days. And before a test match, Neville Lodge would prepare three cartoons, one for an All Black win, one for an All Black loss, and one for a draw. And the people in the typesetting of the newspaper would be listening on the radio to Winston McCarthy's commentary from all over New Zealand, and that the whistle goes at the end of the game, they'd take the appropriate cartoon and they'd put it on the front of the Sports Post, so that when you got onto the streets at 6 o'clock, there would be Neville Lodge's view of the outcome of the test, wherever it was played in New Zealand. So what I'd like to know these days is what happened to all the other cartoons that would probably be very, very funny and part of the Wellington history, but were probably destroyed because the All Blacks result from one cartoon had been published on the front, and so that the need to keep the other programs was not required. But these were all parts of the community that we lived in rugby in those days. And we talked about rugby endlessly. Men and women, the rugby blokes, by the way, they talked a lot about fighting. If you went to your game, you would go to the pub after, didn't you? Say, I gave that so-and-so one in the second half because he gave me one in the first half. And they talked about fighting. People don't talk about fighting these days in rugby, and that's a good thing, a very good thing, because that's a lot of what was talked about after the games was about tough people in rugby. And but anyway, that was all part of the community of the game, and it was such a great thing to be involved in. And thank you, Dave, for giving me the chance for this old joker to delve back into my memories, because they're still so fresh in my mind after living about the rugby and, if you like, following the bouncing ball for all of it, since I was first lured into it as a boy standing behind Winston McCarthy and Danny Craven at Wellington College.
An absolute pleasure, Keith Quinn. Thanks for joining us on the Etu Whānau Footy Show.